Hello, Tom. So good to see you.
Yeah, likewise.
It's been so long.
It's been so long, man.
I'm very happy to hear that your love life is back in the that you're back in the saddle. In any case, so that hopefully that will provide inspiration for the show. I had an excellent discussion with Jordan Hall last night. Love talking to him, great guy.
What
Uh,
was that
he
about?
he 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 told me why he took the route from becoming a tech billionaire. He was on the road to becoming a tech billionaire,
Yeah.
and he took another route.
To
I think he
what?
was pr probably pretty lucky to have taken that other route.
What is the other route?
The other route is, I don't know, kind of a homesteading lifestyle, in a spiritual practice and philosophy and religion and,
Yeah.
and being a parent and, kind of, he's building a house somewhere. That's what he's trying to, he has this whole project called Civium, which is trying to think about like how people live, and how people live and how people will live in the future. There's a movement out of cities, out of dense urban areas.
Yeah.
So
Nice.
he
So
has a new article out, and
that
his
was a like
articles kind of I he kind of when he puts out an article, people tend to pay attention, and then he tends to introduce neologism into the and then all the people we know start to talk about the blue church and the red church and a blue sorry the red religion. So anyway, so he also mentioned that he's going to write a few things. So he'll be doing some writing, which he hasn't been doing. He's mostly been talking on podcasts and or getting
Yeah.
his ideas out on YouTube.
Right.
So very, very interesting and strange individual.
Wants to join the club of people with lots of ideas, nobody can act on. Know what?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. I mean, he's got his hands in things like tech things that people, actual projects that people are doing. And he's pretty well connected, I would say. And
I was laughing so much because I there's this alumni from Robert Anton Wilson. He says all models are wrong, but some are more useful than others.
that's right, that's true,
You
absolutely
know,
true.
and then and so we talked about this, in the beginning before we started the recording. I'm doing this translation work for this other publishing house, and it's a lot of tarot stuff. And it's easy money. It's not very challenging, but after doing a bunch of those works, it's just about women, writing some tarot books. They're just making the shit up, and it's like that's what we do. Like in philosophy, we just
We make
make.
shit up, yeah.
Yeah,
But
it's so
some
funny.
shit has gravity to it, and other shit just floats up in the air and disappears. It's just a form of masturbation. I think, some shit has a bit of gravity to it and others doesn't. So a lot of this new age stuff is, yeah, it's like
Yeah,
put a
but
little
yeah.
bit of mix a little bit of, tarot with numerology and add some, Hindu words and then Chinese pictograms and mix it with some Mayan prophecy, and it's a whole soup of mixture and add colors and numbers and oh, this is going to change your life, and people are like, oh great, people buy
Yeah,
that
no,
stuff.
women like that shit. But on the other side, we like Sloterdijk and Zizek, and I'm reading Less Than Nothing now, and it's the same thing in blue. He just makes shit up. He's
Yeah, it's a
like,
different, I guess male bullshit is always conceptual.
yeah, and
And
it's
it's all
super interesting. It
it's
speaks to my
Oh yeah, right. We love this conceptual masturbation, right?
Yeah, but it's super interesting. He's a great storyteller. Sloterdijk is a great storyteller, but I'm still. It's just,
It's
made
just
up.
made up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just stories.
Yeah. I
Mind
think
stories.
Hegel. I mean, because I think like Hegel was just a big troll. That's what I think now. You know,
it's just like the first. Don't tell Cadell; he'll be very angry at you.
The first
don't say that to Cadell; he'll be upset. People really love Hegel. They love Hegel. They're in love with Hegel.
No, but I think Cadell might be the only person who actually read Hegel. But it's like I can read Zizek, and that's. It's not particularly an easy read, but it's like I can work with that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, me too. Yeah. I've read several big tomes of Zizek. Like, it's the kind of book I like to read on the toilet, to tell you the truth. It's not the kind of book I like to read, like, very seriously.
Maybe you wrote it on the toilet. You know, you never know.
It's not the kind of book. I mean, it's a little heavy to carry with you to the toilet, but because it's such a big book, you know, and it looks so serious and everything, but. It's not like the book that I put on my highest part of my bookshelf.
Also, it has like
considered to be very precious. What?
Also, it has more like 1,000 pages than the German edition. So if you run out of toilet paper, you always have, you know.
Right, it's pretty good toilet paper material. And then I read it and I enjoy it and kind of went like when I'm on vacation. Like, I guess people read like police. It's the kind of book I like to read in the airport or less than nothing. But I guess that makes me weird.
You know, I think, you know, because like Zizek starts with Wittgenstein, you know, and he says like everything that can be said should be said clearly. It's not an exact quote, but it's something like that. You know, it's
seconds here. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just had a sound issue. Yeah, excuse me.
I do hear you. So if you have something of value or anything to ask, you should try to say it clear and precise. And you know, you have at least some debt to the, you're indebted in some way to the reader to make your thoughts, you know, accessible or understandable in some way. I mean, you're...
Well, that's a very German perspective.
Yeah, no, but you can be challenging. That's not, you know, the issue. But you should at least have some pointers of, you know, how to read your own text and make it accessible to, you know, you should be able to formulate a thought clearly and precise. And I feel like every time I'm opening a book of Hegel, it's just like, no, he's just a big troll. He doesn't give a shit, you know?
Well, have you read Beelzebub and His Uncle, the book from Gurdjieff? You know that book?
That's something.
Beelzebub and His Grandson. What?
That's something else entirely because
is he it made, why?
Why? Because he made up a language and he made up words because his idea was that, you know, he wants to disrupt the automatic processing of the reader. And so he has like this jumble book of words and but the general architecture and the grammatic of the text, it's still a normal readable text. With new words in it, and so.
But it's supposed to be written for your unconscious. Yeah, that's the difference. It's actually written for your unconscious, not your conscious mind. I've heard him say.
Yeah, but the kind of structure of the structure of the text is just normal literature.
Yeah,
it's not Finnegan's Wake or something. You know, because like James Joyce said, he wrote Finnegan's Wake to occupy the minds of the critics for the next 400 years. And so there's like no apparent structure of the text that you can apply your thinking to. It's just like, it's just a big mess. But Gurdjieff is not like this. You have a very clear-cut text. They're like these words that have no meaning or no apparent meaning because you don't know them. But with a little bit of reasoning, you understand what he means.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But that's not, you know, that's not what Hegel is. It's just like, he's just, in a certain sense, I think he's a troll, you know.
He's extremely frustrating to me. Every time I picked him up, I found it, because I've been told to read Hegel over and over again, and all these dudes are loving Hegel, and especially Zizekians, they think we need to all read Hegel. And so I take that seriously, and then I try, and then I have a very frustrating experience. But if I read Zizek, because perhaps I'm not a very good philosopher, I can enjoy Zizek and get some of his what he gets from Hegel secondhand, and that's the best I can do. I mean, that's what I figure. Unless I'm going to be a professional philosopher, because if you're a professional philosopher, then you can really. I mean, I don't know when Hegel writes 2 pages of text, very dense, obscure, bizarre. hard to understand text, and you the only meaning you can get garner from them is, well, water dissolves, you know, at a certain temperature, or something like that, right? Or has a phase change. I do wonder why he couldn't put that into like a shorter sentence.
So there's this joke, you know, and the tragedy is that it's true, though. There's like this YouTube philosophy professor who spent the last 10-15 years to make 820 YouTube lectures around the phenomenology of spirit. And in the end, it's like every
that's Cadell. That's the,
no, no, it's not Cadell.
Be careful. What? That's what he does.
Because it's like 820, 818 different lectures about the book. And at the end, after this 10-15 years quest to delve into this book, he adds, well, I have to start reread the book again. And it's like, that's such a troll move, you know, from Hegel. Just like, how can I, you know, it's like, what can I do to make people aware of the fact that it's a big joke? You know,
maybe I'm just too dumb to understand Hegel. I don't know. Maybe I just, you know, I'm trying to play the devil's advocate here because I've been, you know, I've been feeling that way too, Tom. I have the Hegel blues as well. It's like,
I don't know what it is. I mean, I can. I don't know. It's just something in the language. I'm, you know, we talked with Cadell about this. Probably he was probably a very good speaker, you know, an engaging public speaker. You know,
yeah,
I believe that. But it's just this writing. It just sucks, really.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well,
and I wonder how high the percentage of people that claim to have read Hegel actually is. You know, I wonder that, because it's like, you know,
yeah, I think it's a certain type of mind that gets off on that kind of thing and can read Hegel. And then, like, I think I have more of a gestalt-y type of mind. I like poetry. I like the unspoken. I like implied meaning. I like things that are symbolic and dense and that way. I don't like I like there to be something I can sink my teeth into, you know?
Yeah, but I don't have a problem with Schopenhauer. I can read 800.
Oh, no, me neither. I can read Schopenhauer.
I can read 800 and Luhmann, and, you know, and that's, you know, it's also a complicated text because it's very dense, but, you know, there's at least some structure and some form to it, you know, and some, internal consistency. But it's just like maybe I don't have the eye to see that. You know, it's just gibberish.
And maybe the Hegel people don't have the eye to see what you see. So we're both kind of live in our own worlds, right? We don't really understand the other person's world.
Yeah, that's what I mean. We're just making shit up, you know?
We're just making shit up. So you know, I'm just trying to have some empathy for those Hegel readers. They sit there and they read Hegel and then they have these moments of intense, you know, bliss because if they're understanding something, and wow, Hegel is just, this phrase is just, it's just, you know, dynamite.
Yeah, it's a little bit like this dress where nobody could decide if the colors are, you know, white and greenish or white, yellow and goldish or something. You remember that meme where everybody who looked at that picture was like, oh no, that dress looked like this, you know, and no, these are completely different colors. Do you remember that thing?
Yeah,
and this is like, you know, it's like if I read different people talking or hear different people talking about Hegel, it seems as if they weren't even talking about the same subject. You know, even if you compare the English speaking, you know, the English Wikipedia with the German Wikipedia, that's like completely two different things completely. You know, mm-hmm. because like the German reception, I told you this, it's just like, focus mostly on the fact that he was a theologian and that, for example, his idea of the absolute was a kind of reimagining the idea of God, you know, so that's, you know, where the German reception comes in from, you know.
Oh, and then the English reception has been influenced by the Zizekian school and these various different schools of thought that they've interpreted in English. Yeah, and so they've made their own Hegel in a way. Well, I heard this, you know, I heard people say that about sort of Derrida and postmodernism, that Derrida was huge in American universities in the 80s.
Yeah.
I think it's Derrida. But it was translations of Derrida which appealed to Americans. And so when I ask my students, like, who's Jacques Derrida, I'm saying his name wrong. They don't know who he is. Nobody in France knows who he is, but everybody in America knows who he is. So he's become more American than French. Or we have an American version of this thinker.
Yeah, I mean, there is a problem with translation, you know, like structurally speaking, you know, because like...
Because it's impossible.
Yeah, well, it's an approximation.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, apparently, you know, Žižek speaks French and he understands German. And so that's, you know, as far as I can see, that's hugely beneficial, you know, if...
of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So again, I've read his book about Lacan. It's, you know, fascinating read. Really, it's really good, you know, So to see his reading of, you know, these authors. But I don't know. I don't know what it is. I will take it to my grave, this unresolved conflict, let's say.
Yeah, me too, I guess. Or I'll just try to be happier in the world that I understand instead of trying to understand petit object and whatever these fucking words, like petit object, like fuck off. Sorry. It's not, there's no poetry in that language. It's so technical and weird and twisted and bizarre. And I'm sure that Lacan is a genius of some kind, but I don't taste it. I don't feel it. I feel like it's a rabbit hole that has no end. That's kind of what I feel about these thinkers are sort of rabbit holes that you could go down, you know, and explore infinite worlds of the mind, but it would still be a world of the mind. It would still just be mind.
Yeah.
Mind stuff.
You know, but the question that I ask myself, so if every, you know, model is basically untrue, or let's say an approximation to something, you know, because mm-hmm. we can never really know. And the worth and the value of a model is dependent on its, you know, applicability or its usage for certain users or readers. So it's like, if you compare the huge amount of women that devour, you know, this silly, naive,
New Age literature.
New Age literature, which is for them hugely, hugely, you know, useful. You know, it's like they and then you have, you know, like a very specific text from Lacan. So which is like, which is more worth, you know, it's like.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if we're talking about sexual difference here. And what, you know, because you're saying women are like this and men are like this, and the culture wants us to say, no, we're all the same. The tarot and this kind of things, there's an authentic version of that. And then there's every other, then the authentic version is this, I think, probably as close to the source as you can get of that. So is it just fully made up? Or is it some sort of emergence? That's a question.
But let's say I, over the years, I translated 10, 15 different tarot books, little tarot books for women.
Yeah.
It's always the same subject. 22, 21 big arcane, you know, cards, and 56 of the little ones.
What's the subject? How to feel good.
No, yeah, but it's always, they just made shit up. There's no internal inherent consistency there. That's the weird thing. It's just like, oh no, we run it through the T filter or the Mayan astro filter, and then we see what's coming out there. But there's no, you know, internal consistency across the different decks and interpretations. And it's just like, oh no, she made that up, you know, and she sells that. That's
well,
great.
If it's a piece of art, you know, it can be made up in a sense. But yeah, it's a funny thing. Like I like Jirovsky's interpretation of the tarot because it's very, it's like, okay, let's go back to the basics here, like the
Yeah,
basic
but
basics.
that's your kind of analytical setup of mind that finds that attractive. I think if you would give that Jodorowsky tarot to some woman, she would say, like, what is that shit?
Oh, he had a lot of women that were involved with him,
Yeah, but you get
and
what I'm saying,
yeah,
no?
sure. Well, I'm sure there's some sophisticated women out there who are doing good work,
But
but
we're generalizing here.
we're generalizing. There's a lot of flake. So there's a so can we say, just to be equal, to be fair to both the sexes, men are insanely hyperconceptual and stupid in that way, and women are insanely sort of, let's say, speculative about things, you know, and dreamy about things in that other way. Like there's like speculative bullshit on one side, I don't know if that's the right word even, but and then
You must.
hyper-artistic literalism on the other side,
Yeah.
something like that.
But in the end, it's
Yeah.
just stories, you know, because the way we understand, you know, everything that, you know, Zizek or Sloterdijk, it's just a story. It's the stories that we as men kind of integrate, you know, to navigate, you know, better in the world, you know, through a better understanding. But women basically do the same. You know, it's just like,
And they're with a different in a different way, yeah.
yeah,
D
I don't
different needs. Well, I know that like men tend to be engineers and women tend to study psychology. That's kind of telling, right?
know. Yeah.
Like women tend to want to psychologize, and that's why these tarots are sort of psychology heuristics. And men tend to want to, you
Let's get
know,
rid of the word tend. You know,
theorize.
let's
Okay, you want to
stereotype.
just, okay, I'm trying to,
Let's stereotype
I'm
because you're not
trying
allowed to. You know, let's go for it. Women are like this.
to,
Women are like
women are like this and men are like this. And so you just stay where you are, you're in your place. Get back to the kitchen.
Yeah,
You know, men belong in the boardroom and women belong in the kitchen, obviously.
Oh man, yes.
Yeah. So
No.
somebody will make a clip of that and they'll put it out on YouTube and
I'm
then
still
they'll
hoping.
describe us
Still,
as
I'm
Nazi
waiting.
fascists.
I'm waiting. It never happens, you know? You know,
Why doesn't
it's
it
so.
happen to us? Because we say all kinds of things that you know
Yes.
you're not allowed to say.
I'm doing this show with Marsha, you know? And so we
Yeah.
had like this thing where we talked about Russell Brand, and it's really hard to create a bad take on things because, you know, you talk and so you have all these kinds of sensors, internal sensors in your mind, and you
Yeah.
can't say this because you go through life and it's like, okay, maybe you phrase it differently. You're not trying to be that offensive, but to actually give you the room and the space to be as offensive as you can, that's really a tough exercise because you're not trained to
You have
do
to be
that.
a comedian to do that, I think, because
Yes.
comedians can, you have to make it funny.
Yeah.
If you don't make it funny, then you know. Then you're just being an asshole, right? But if you make it funny, you can be an asshole and be funny at the same, like you have to have a sense of irony towards yourself, I would
Yeah, or
say.
just be an asshole, you know, every once in a while, you know, just to be able to, you know, because if you're all the time inhibited to, you know, not to be an asshole, you know, like to not say certain things, but it's really an art form to be a proper asshole, as is an art form to be a proper comedian, you know, but it's not easy,
To be a
you know,
good asshole,
yeah,
who
to be
would
a
you put
really
in
good
that? Like
asshole.
Nassim Taleb, he's kind of an asshole, right?
Yeah, well, I don't think that in real life he's that of an asshole. He has like this Twitter persona.
Yeah, he's probably a nice guy in real life, and then he just puts on an
You see
asshole
that
thing
when
on
you,
Twitter.
because it's like he barely gets a proper sentence out if he's like in a live interview, you know, on television. Then he like mumbles and, you know, stumbles, you know, around his own words.
Yeah,
It's
he's
like
not.
he's super.
He does not have a charisma.
None.
He doesn't have any charisma, does he? That's interesting.
Great.
Yeah.
He's great in his writing. He's super. He's, you know, he's funny. He is like eloquent, and then he has like this completely different personality on Twitter, where he's like basically only an asshole. And then you see him live, and he says, "Oh no, that's a weird dude. You know, he's a nerd. he's just a nerd. You know."
Yeah. He's just an odd Lebanese man.
He barely gets a sentence out.
Yeah, but I guess that is, if you want to be good at Twitter, you have to be kind of an asshole,
right?
You know, like Jordan Peterson's always being, you know, kind of an asshole these days on Twitter. He's got this political agenda, and he's just you know, pushing it to the max.
Yeah, but he's not an asshole.
By being sarcastic about everything, you know, just sarcasm.
But he's not a proper, like, still, I think Nassim Taleb is a proper asshole, you know, on Twitter.
Yeah, he's too earnest to be a real asshole. You mean, Jordan, he takes it too seriously to be a real asshole. Yeah.
I still try to find a way to find a doorway, social network wise, to some comedians, because I think, you know, the whole of our liminal web could benefit hugely from, you know, some, you know, comedic infusion of, you know, that's the way to do it, you know. It's like, how many minutes are we in this fucking podcast? So we're like 30
we're
minutes.
We're okay. We have lots of time.
That's because, like, have you seen the Daniel Schmachtenberger kind of video where he's just like, everything is going to shit.
He's like, nail me up to the cross.
Yes. It's like, what the fuck, man? What the fuck? Yeah. It's like the world is shit. Yeah, but the world is also beautiful. The world is interesting. The world is always, you know, trying to find solutions. And this doomsday mongering, it's like, what is that? Why? I mean, I get that the world has some problems, but I don't think that if we add, you know, like a doomsday perspective on top of the problems that we already have, it doesn't make things better.
We're all Protestants fundamentally.
But that's what I mean. It's just like, what is that? You know, it's like,
yeah. I was like trying to think about like the good side of Protestantism, because I'm always using Protestantism as a kind of like a negative. And the negative Protestantism is this sort of Calvinist kind of like, work really hard. We're all going to die. There's no hope. You know, the only thing we can do is have grace, or, you know, whatever the and then this is sort of the American, you know, European and be repentant all the time, kind of. And so what is the good side of Protestantism? So I guess it breaks down the formalism, all the formalisms of traditional religion, and wants to get to the heart of things. But then it tears down what Bard calls the Bard absolute. It tears down the membrane, so it tends to lead to sort of craziness.
Yeah.
Of course I'm using a sweeping thing in Protestant, but we, one guy told me, it's like, you're all Protestants, every one of you, you're all Protestants. And it's like, I was like, yes, we're all Protestants. We're all so Protestant because we have all this self-consciousness and doubt and doomsday fear. And we want to impress God, but we don't know how. And we're so, it's just, and then so we have to work and work and work and work and work. And we don't know how to enjoy life. We're so complicated. We feel like we're sinners, and so we have to go to therapy all the time. And, you know,
I tell you what it is.
What is it?
I think because, you know, I think, for example, woke, that's a postmodern interpretation of Protestantism. Right,
woke is like, Protestantism.
Yeah,
yes.
Because like woke, you have like, if you look at the Salem witch trials, that was like a very early form of woke, and so you have like in every era and every stage of development, you have a incarnation of woke, and I think that's because it's highly infused by this kind of moralistic Christian worth ethic, doomsday kind of thinking that if the rules are not applied in our lives, then everything will go to shit. And so that happens, you know, as Max Weber said, like since the inception of Protestantism, Martin Luther and all of this. And so you have this postmodern Protestantism, which is like woke. But I think, there's also like an integral or metamodern woke. And that's what Schmachtenberger is. He's metamodern woke. It's like, oh no, the world is going to shit and we have to, it's like, really? No, it's like still the world is great and it has beauty and there's laughter and it has emergence and transcendence and it's like I get
yeah.
That's a problem, but it's not all of it. And but if you just zoom in into and he started his talk about, oh, I know, now I will have this talk and you will all do your notes. But then you go home and then you open your laptop and you answer some emails, blah, 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 blah. And then you will forget it. You know, my sermon, basically, you will forget the sermon that I do in this, super.
Yeah,
rich.
I think you're right. Well, yeah, sermons. Yeah.
That's just a preacher on the metamodern integral, code on the algorithm. It's just woke on another level. And just like, really, we still do this Christian thing now. It's still... that's it.
Well, we can't denigrate it completely, but it is Christian. It's very interesting.
I was just denigrating completely.
I know. But I was thinking when we were at the Merge Festival and, Jonathan Rosen was giving his opening talk and everybody was listening and nodding their heads. And then there was a moment where they had to, we had to greet the neighbor and it's basically church what was going on was basically church.
Right.
And I'm not saying that's a negative thing or that his speech wasn't good and that there wasn't some real, something real going on there. There could very easily be something real going on there, but it is still church. So this tells me that I don't know what your thing is, but I think we need temples and churches and preachers and we need that. I think we could I think that's a positive thing. Even though there's different levels of maybe we're preaching right now. Maybe we are preachers in another way, in another temple of some kind.
No, I think like everything has its place, and there is a place for critiquing the way we are engaging with the world. There's a place for critiquing, institutions, and there's a way of critiquing, or have visions for a future. And there's a place for a sermon, let's say. Okay, let them have their space. But it's like maybe that's quarter of a third of the cake, So because there's also laughter, there's also transcendence, there's art, there's
for sure.
There's so it's like
totally.
What is your framing? It's like you want to enter this metamodern integral era with the Protestant pointy fingers that's not, I don't feel that's the thing. And so we also need a place for the comedy cellar, let's say, an integral comedy center where we just can make fun of all these, super earnest ways of pretending that our models of the world are real because they're not, they're just approximations,
Yeah.
And people that take themselves too seriously, really. It's like, why? What is that? It has that place, but it's not the only place. That's what I'm saying. It's not the only approach to
life. Of course.
Life.
Well, so you go to church. Let's say you go and listen to a talk by Daniel Schachtenberger or whoever, and that's like you listen. Like if you're home with your Zoom, it's a little different. But maybe you're in a Zoom room or something, and there's other people there, and you look at them, and you're like, you're in church, and then you go, and then you leave the church, and then like somebody smokes a cigarette, somebody tells a dirty joke, you go to the bar, you fool around, it's not the entire, as you say, it's just part of the whole tapestry.
No, I mean, like if you have a like a talk by, for example, Schmachtenberger, but for the highly affluent, wealthy people, basically, that can afford to fly to Norway from the United States just on a whim, basically. So you have them on the stage. So let a trickster come in after him and make fun of all of this.
You know,
like a clown who says, like, okay, I get, was like, okay, maybe, you know. And
yeah,
so
I totally agree. Like,
hmm?
Well, for example, Saint-Sulpice Church in Paris, it used to be painted with bright colors, and they used to have theater in there, and you know, and they, and one of the, a lot of the stuff they do is they would make fun of the preacher, and they, you know, they do a comedy skit based on the preacher. There was all kinds of possibility of inversion and humor and stuff like this, and then as the culture developed and became more Protestant, it became this very solemn and serious kind of affair, but it wasn't like that.
Yeah,
I don't think in the early days. I think that's a fragmented version, right? This intense solemnness. I
mean, the interesting thing is there was like a couple of years ago, there was like something of an integral conflict. I don't know if it was in Budapest or Germany. I don't remember, but you know, everybody had, you know, from the integral community, that solemn, you know, integral perspective on the world. And then in came Suzanne Cook-Reuter, and she wasn't playing, you know, doing a comedy bit, but it was, you know, there was a little bit of trickster in there. And she was like critiquing that very approach to life.
Yeah, Bonita does that too. Yeah.
And so people are still talking about this, because it's like you have, and if like a matriarch and like an academic matriarch, it's like she developed, you know, the adult development stage model in the to begin with, but she came in and she hijacked the whole event, basically, and people still feed off of that, you know, because they know, you know, it's just like.
They feed off it in what sense? Because they
know, you know, it's like this Protestant, you know, solemn kind of approach. It has its value, but it's only one facet of everything, and you have to counterbalance that by some, you know, tricksterian kind of playfulness of all of this.
Well, and when I met my own teacher, he told me that, like, what I'm interested in is dharma, truth, right? But also fooling around, those two things. I don't care about anything else. So truth, super earnest pursuit of truth, and fooling around. And total outrageous, wild, silly nonsense, playfulness.
Yeah, because you have
I think that's a good religious tradition that has both those things, that has the earnest, the practices and the teachings and the structure, but it also has a way to completely subvert that, turn it upside down utterly, and laugh at it and mock it, and you know, there has to be both those things going on.
Yeah, I think, you know, the thing is that there is a like a current that you think that you can win at the game of life. You can't win the game of life. But what the Protestant mindset is trying to tell you is that you can, by worth ethic, by the right morals, you know, by everything. But
no, it's even worse. It's telling you you should do all those things, and you won't achieve it either. You know, only God can.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah,
it's an even worse thing. It's like you do all these pursuits with the sense of futility and original sin, and.
But then, what's the right approach to life? And it's like, yeah, you should. I mean, there are some positive aspects of Protestantism, and you should do your thing. But on the other side, as you say, you should be able to, you know, just be completely open and to hijack your own approach to life and to have fun and to laugh and mm-hmm. to you know what I'm saying? It's just like, it's not just, you know, this earnestness of everything. And I'm always coming back to this, and strangely, it's even encoded in metamodernism. It is, you know, earnest and sincerity, but it's also irony and playfulness. And I feel like, you know, it's the theory is there, but as soon as these people start to talk, they
go into the earnestness,
yeah,
and also the playfulness is sort of contrived. It's like, let's be playful. and now it's like children and doing playful things for it, and then go back to our earnestness.
Right.
That's sort of a silly thing either. And even the idea of play, it like there's an infantile quality to that.
Right. I don't know.
No, but that's why people are attracted to metamodernism, that principle.
It's a great principle, you know, that, you know, mm-hmm. I love that. But, you know, again, as soon as those people start to talk, then they're falling back on the modern stage and pretend as if the world is as it's presented to their eyes, you know, and it's as if, you know, the Protestant ethic is, you know, the way to go. But it's like these are old codes.
They're all codes. Well, how do you break those codes? It's not easy. Those codes are deep, man.
That's why you need comedians. That's what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yes, you have to break the codes. You know, you have to allow the old codes to kind of like wear themselves out. I think this is one of the things I was talking with Jordan last night. It was about how like, yeah, we have the things, something gets built and it's supposed to be permanent. Right, we don't know how to let go of the structure that we've built and allow it to dissolve, so something new can arise. So, you know, something like integral theory comes, and then people get very, very attached to it, and it becomes a sort of superstructure, and it becomes a place where nerdy people can hang out and talk about things, and but I think that the more interesting people in that community sort of allow that to die, right? And the people who are not that interesting are kind of holding on to something from the, you know, late 90s or, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe metamodernism is the same. I don't know. There seems to be some vitality in, I guess, that community. But at the same time, there's an evangelization of what it is, and that kind of kills it.
Yeah, again, it's like if you treat it as a sacred cow, you know, as if it's true. And it's like, again, all these models are wrong in the end, but some are more useful than others. And I still think if you look at integral theory or these models have, you know, a lot of appliances and applications, right? And so they're useful.
But
to know that there are moments when they're not useful. You know, they're not the ultimate truth about the universe. You know, it's just, you know, it's an idea, but it's not everything. And if you know that, you know, the whole model has, you know, a big bracket around them, you know, you can use them and you can put them aside and you can take another model, you know, and I think that's, you know.
Sure.
But for that, you need comedy and you need like the trickster kind of archetype to help you to let go of your hope that particular model is your salvation, basically.
Yeah, the genuine trickster, because I think there's a lot of pseudo tricksters out there. There's a lot of kind of like everybody's supposed to be a shaman or a trickster.
Yeah.
There's something about that is a little bit phony as well. Sometimes the trickster is in disguise, you know, he doesn't appear to be that at all.
Yeah, that's what I mean. When Suzanne Cook-Reuter, she wasn't playing the trickster or clown card. She was actually kind of critiquing what was going on in that particular event. But the archetypal effect was that of a trickster, because she was like kind of going to the, you know, mimetic base structure of the...
Yeah.
Or beliefs of these people, and kind of, you know, putting a wedge into it.
Yeah, there's a great Tibetan yogi, and what he used to do was like he rode a horse and had a gun, and he used to shoot his gun all the time, and he'd go into monasteries and take a shit in the monastery, and then he'd go and have sex with the nun on the altar, and then he'd leave. He'd do things like that. All the time.
Yeah.
And that was his kind of way of teaching. It's like, always undermining people's reified holiness, or, you know,
yeah,
people, because people get very holy about things. They get very, as you say, solemn and holy and attached to their models, but, yeah, and, but the models are not real, are they? They're,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. And then there this great yogi from Tibet who came in, and he punched him in the face. It's like, it's just, this is what we should do. Yeah, sometimes.
We should at least find a way to invite comedians. I mean, you know that I love these guys from the Dirtbag Left, you know, Adam Friedland, Nick Mullen, you know, these guys with that kind of come from the left, but kind of are able to critique the woke left, because they're hijacking it, or, you know, Kill Tony, these comedy shows that have like no filter, basically, in regard of any, how do you say it, hold conceptions, basically. And so that's something that we need, you know, some way to find, you know, a doorway to these networks. So if any comedian listens to this bullshit here and wants to chime in, you're invited.
Comedians are funny, huh? 'Cause they live in their own universe. They're kind of like, they're like tropical fish. They can only really hang around with other comedians. They're not comfortable with anybody else.
Yeah.
it's a weird thing. Comedians are very strange.
Mm.
Yeah. Because they have to be in this mode all the time of humor. And if they're in a serious situation, they're just not going to be comfortable. Or I don't know, or they'll play some game, or they, because they constantly have to subvert the thing, or
right, which is great. Yeah,
so that is what they do. They subvert the norm.
I get what you're saying, but
that's what they have to do, and that's what they need to do, and that's what their function is, and that's what's great about them.
Yeah, but we as a human people, we only learn through mimicry, right? And and you know, if you look at the liminal web or whatever that is, you know, it's just like we need comedians to start to mimic their behavior in regard of ourselves, because it's that, you know, to have like a kind of self-deprecating humor, and nobody is like, that is what's so missing in this whole thing, you know, because everybody is trying to sell, you know, their books, their courses, whatnot. I mean, we're doing this. It's like we're not different in the sense. But, you know, to learn that from comedians
Well, there's a way in which, yeah, you're right. So even though that we might not be gifted with the same ability, we can take a little bit of that.
That's what I mean, through mimicry.
Poison that they give us and kind of use that.
Like, yes.
We're not comedians, right? We're doing something else, but we can still be a little bit funny at times. Subversively funny, not making a joke just for the sake of making a joke and being cute or anything, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, I don't know where to find these people.
Hmm.
Because they're also like tight-knit groups, you know, if you look at, you know, Chapo Trap House. I mean, they're not comedians, but, you know, Red Scare, Adam Friedland, Louis J. Gomez. It's like they're all kind of, Ari Shaffir, they're all kind of hang out together. They're like, as you said, they're, you know.
This is what Seinfeld said in one of his things. Like, I don't like other kinds of people. I can only hang out with comedians. I just don't like anybody else.
Yeah.
Because if nobody else is, funny. And why would you want to hang around with somebody who's not funny? It's like, that's how they roll, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
They're not exactly actors. They don't like actors very much, because actors take themselves like way too seriously, and they're always silly a bit.
But culturally, it's also very
a different kind of beast.
It's also interesting that culturally speaking, the moment when woke, you know, postmodern woke really started, you know, a couple of years ago, 10, 15 years ago, that was like, no, 8 to 10 years ago. That was the exact same time that kind of comedy kind of got a huge push into public, you know, consciousness.
It's a counter reaction. For sure. Well, that's as a dialectic, right? When woke comes, then its opposite will appear at the same time, right? To counter it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There will be always something, something to counter whatever appears to be the opposite of what it is.
Right.
So there's Daniel Schmachtenberg. What's the opposite of Daniel Schmachtenberg?
I don't know, but at least we identified him as integral woke. So that's one step.
Yeah. Again, I don't like. You're much better at insulting people than I am. I wouldn't want to insult Daniel. I wouldn't want to assault Daniel with a label like that, but you can.
But what else would you call it, really?
What else would you call what he does?
Mm.
Well, he's a brilliant guy.
Obviously, but that's not the point.
And he has something to say, and I'll take that.
Obviously, but still, that's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is to make, you know, the thing of what is legit, you know, legitimate, to make that the whole thing, you know, to critique, you know, the time between worlds, or, you know, to identify and analyze the time between worlds as everything that there is. And I don't think that it is.
I think that it is everything, the time between worlds.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is. We're always in the time between worlds.
Yeah, well, I don't know. We had this discussion at other places, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think, what I want to say is, I think, you know, the Protestant moralizing finger is the only stance that you can have in this world. I seriously doubt that.
The Protestant, moralizing finger.
So there's also joy and fucking and ecstasy and music and dancing and making art. And
yeah, but that's everywhere, Tom. That's not, you know, this is a point that Thomas Helmerich was making, which I sort of agreed with. He said that the barred absolute is the sutric, right? Everybody's fucking and doing all kinds of things. And that's not very radical anymore.
Okay, that wasn't very differentiated what I said. What I
everybody's
meant is
doing neo-tantra.
There are different ways.
You know, what?
You know, it's you shouldn't attach the moralizing finger as the only thing that is, you know, what metamodernism or integral is. There's so much more. There's integral way of experiencing and creating art, of creating transcendence. You know, there are holy things that are beautiful still. You know, the world is not, the world has problems, but it's not the only perspective that you could possibly have on this world.
Oh, yeah, God, agree.
That's all what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And our ability to overcome problems, that's an immense, you know, motor of joy and hopefulness and everything.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
That's all
without being naive, you know, to say that things are going to get pretty bad, but we still have to have a sense of humor and have a bit of chutzpah or something.
Yeah, but again, you can't win this game of life. You know, it's like, as Norm Macdonald said, it's like it's incrementally getting worse, and it ends in catastrophe. That's true for ourselves. We will all die. And that is also true for society and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And so you have to have a positive outset of this absurdity called life.
You have to have a positive relationship to death.
Right. There you go.
There, I think that is it. That's what you're saying, and I agree totally.
Thank you.
I'm gonna die. Let's have a positive relationship to that. Instead of being whiny children, oh no, we're all gonna die.
Exactly.
Yeah, that totally agree.
Yeah, that was, thank you, Andrew. That was it.
Now we've got it.
Over and out.
We got it, excellent.